They look a little like the dogs we share our homes with, but they are very, very different. This hour, we'll talk about wild canines, foxes, coyotes, and wolves. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today, and he will definitively answer the question that so many YouTube viewers around the world have been asking. What does the fox say? We will talk about the two kinds of foxes that are native to Iowa, the red fox and the gray fox. We'll also talk about coyotes and a wild canine that doesn't live in the state anymore, the wolf. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we're going to talk about the wild canines of Iowa, or at least that are native to the state of Iowa. We'll talk about foxes, coyotes, and wolves, although wolves don't live here anymore. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today. Hello, Jim.
Hello, and what a beautiful day we have. It seems like winter.
Suddenly. I'm hoping this is just a brief visit from winter.
We had about 10 degrees yesterday morning, so my ponds froze over, and it's like, huh, gee whiz, this is very winter-like.
Yes, absolutely. Well, Jim, I was the one who suggested talking about foxes, and I have to say that the reason that the subject was on my mind is because I have seen a couple of red foxes lately in the state of Iowa.
Sure.
But also, foxes have been on the minds of millions of people because of a song put out by a pair of Norwegian brothers. We'll play a little bit of it in a little while.
Okay.
All right. So the song is What Does the Fox Say? And millions of people have been watching this on YouTube. And, of course, the answer that they have is not very similar to what actual foxes do say. But in Iowa, we have two different kinds of foxes that live here, right?
Yes, we do. We have the red fox, which is the most widely distributed canid in the world. And then we have the gray fox, which is not as common in Iowa, but certainly not uncommon either.
And they are canines, but they seem so very different from the other wild dogs that we're going to talk about today, and the wolf.
Yeah, I guess they do, except the thing that all three of them have in common is they're incredibly adaptable. They really are able to adjust, especially foxes and coyotes. They're able to adjust. All three of them have been subject to such persecution by people throughout history, I think, and yet we have domesticated one of them into our the dogs that so many of us know and love, but yet, when it comes to other canids, we tend to look at them as competitors, I think, for the same resources. So these are amazingly adaptable, and certainly foxes are very different, much smaller for one, but they have a lot of things in common.
Well, and some people would even describe them as seeming feline or cat-like.
Well, and especially because the gray fox, because gray foxes actually climb trees pretty readily, not quite as quickly as a squirrel, but they can certainly climb. And when you see a critter that big up in a tree, it's a double take, you know.
You do think cat, right?
Yes, exactly. They don't come down as gracefully as a cat does, though, either. I have seen them in the woods.
And they need a lot of momentum to get up there, too.
Yes, yeah, they do.
But the red fox is more common than the gray fox. Do we have an idea how big the population is in Iowa?
Well, you know, it certainly varies a lot from year to year, and we don't have a good handle on it. We can look at sort of fur records and the takes of furs, and it runs from hundreds to thousands per year, and it depends a lot. The like most canids, their populations go up and down quite a lot, and foxes in particular are subject to a population controlled by disease, and that is uh, uh, particularly by mange. And mange's cause is that, oh, lots of people have probably seen it in some domestic animals or even in wild critters, where they lose their hair. It's caused by a mite that burrows underneath the skin and actually destroys the hair follicles, and so the hair falls out. And it's generally in different patches, and they look kind of scaly and just really uncomfortable and pretty sick overall. And that is one of the primary diseases that certainly decimates fox populations on a local level. And then a few years later, they're back, and they do very, very well. So, in terms of numbers, like most wildlife species, we don't have anything other than indices to how many there are.
Well, and most of us, if we do see a red fox or a gray fox, we see them briefly.
Yes,
because they're always on the move and running away from us. So we'll see them if we're driving a car or maybe out for a hike, but only briefly.
Right.
What time of day are they most active?
Well, they can be active. Again, they're adaptable, and it depends on the degree of how much they come in contact with human beings. Normally, they would be diurnal. They would be out during the day hunting, but they can also hunt at the dawn and dusk. They're that crepuscular times of day, dawn and dusk, when the light is just right and most people aren't around, and especially early in the morning, and they're out hunting. I recall a call from a former president here of Iowa State a number of years ago that as he walked across from his home on campus to his office on campus, he encountered a fox walking right across the central Iowa State University campus with a great big rabbit and a smile.
Nice.
So he was quite excited about it, and he said, gee, how common are they? And I knew at that time of at least three dens in and around the campus area of Iowa State University in Ames, and so they're pretty adaptable. They come into urban areas as well.
You mentioned that rabbit. What else do they hunt for?
Well, they're big mousers. Their primary food is certainly small mammals, and that includes anything as big as a rabbit. But certainly much more common, lots of mice and voles, small mammals like that. A lot of insects. They'll eat a lot of berries. They're not, particularly those that live in cities, they're certainly accustomed to taking advantage. Opportunistic predators, they all are, and foxes are no different in that sense that they'll take advantage of any carrion that might be available, roadkills, that sort of thing, fruits and vegetables. They'll sort through the garbage occasionally. And certainly those who have small poultry know that they will get into their chickens if they have an opportunity as well. They're going to take whatever is easiest for them, but mice are their primary primary source of food.
Well, you mentioned their dens, and they do dig holes, right?
Yeah, they'll either occupy, take over a den that was dug by a badger or a woodchuck, as long as it's not being occupied by that critter, and they will take them over just as coyotes do, but they will dig their own, and people can frequently find them on the roadside ditches, particularly if it's sort of a mix of woods and grassland sort of area. And they like that area kind of just above the water line. They'll dig into the bank, and they may have more than one. In fact, the ones on the ISU campus here, I knew that two of them had at least, I knew of two other dens for two of the families. So, because you would see them at different places, and if the vixen, that's the female, gets spooked by something, if you get a little too close to something, she may move those pups, those kits, to another one of her den sites in her territory.
And how many kits do they usually have?
Well, four to eight is not uncommon, but five. Six is pretty common.
All right. Well, now I think it is time for us to ask this musical question.
Okay.
Here we go.
Okay.
Dog goes woof, cat goes meow, bird goes tweet, and mouse goes squeak. Cow goes moo, frog goes croak, and the elephant goes toot. Ducks say quack, and fish go blub, and the seal goes ow, ow, ow. But there's one sound that no one knows. What does the fox say?
All right, so the fox doesn't really say ding, 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 ding. Right? What does the fox say, Jim?
Well, I just happen to have a recording here. It is a sharp bark. Let's see if we can get this here. Can you hear that?
Yes. All right, so a sharp bark.
Right.
And that's the red fox?
That's the red fox, right. And the gray fox is very different than that. They have a song that my wife says is a scream.
Very eerie. And the juveniles have a shorter piercing scream with the
right.
gray foxes. We have in my family with of wildlife
have you
rehabilitators,
raised gray
we have raised a gray fox, and she had quite the scream. She really enjoyed the element of surprise, and almost sounded like a great horned owl, a young great horned owl,
yes.
like a rah
yes.
kind of scream. She could really, really get a room.
That was very good.
Thank
have you.
You.
You've been practicing your great horned owls.
You pick things up from association, but we don't. I don't know. We probably, if we hear foxes, we probably don't know that we're hearing foxes.
Well, yeah, I think that unlike coyotes, they don't have that sort of yipping that carries a great distance. Certainly when I've been turkey hunting in the spring and walking in the darkness into the area I was going to hunt and surprised a fox, you can hear it quite a ways, but that those barks don't carry as far. And I think generally people think, oh, that's just a dog barking. You know,
right.
It sounds a little chihuahua-like, I guess. You know? What does the fox say?
Well, and foxes, of course, are known for their cunning. They're known for being very smart. At least we like to think of them that way. Do you think that's an accurate take
yeah.
on it?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. They're really adaptable and can live in lots of places. So, yeah.
All right. We'll continue this conversation in a moment. My guest today is wildlife biologist Jim Pease, and we're talking about wild canines today.
Chasing mice and digging holes, tiny paws up the hill. Suddenly you're standing still. Your fur is red, so beautiful, like an angel in disguise. But if you meet a friendly horse, will you communicate by more?
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about wild canines that are native to the state of Iowa. We've been talking about the red fox and the gray fox, and we're going to talk about coyotes, also wolves, who of course no longer live in the state of Iowa. You can join our conversation with your questions or your observations at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or you can post your questions on our Facebook page. My guest today is wildlife biologist Jim Pease. And Jim, we were talking about both of the different kinds of foxes. Do we have an idea? I talked about wondering how common red foxes are, and there seem to be a lot around that we don't see. How about gray foxes? Do we know how common they are?
Well, they're fairly common. They're not as widely distributed. They're more restricted to areas with more woodland areas of the state. So as you would expect, they're more common in the eastern third of the state, and than they are in the western two-thirds. But certainly you find them along rivers and streams in the western two-thirds. Because that's primarily where our woods are located, along those woods and streams. So they really are statewide, with the exception perhaps of extreme Northwest Iowa, there don't seem to be many, although maybe some of our readers can call in and tell us if they've seen some in that area. But certainly they're more common in the eastern third of the state than they are in the western two-thirds.
All right. And I think even rarer to see them, even if they're around,
yes.
Because they seem more elusive to me.
Yeah.
Maybe that's my...
Oh, no, I think that's true. I don't think they're anywhere near as common. You think of red foxes and by the way, red fox is also, there are lots of color variations of them. So in Canada, they call them colored fox, which is pretty accurate. It's the same species, but some of them come in black up through their legs. The bottoms of their legs are coal black. Some of them come in a black phase where they have silver tips on them. They're called silver fox. Some of them are called cross fox, where they'll have sort of a black line that forms a cross along their back. And over their front two legs, so there's sort of a dark cross up there. So, you know, there are lots of variations in coloration as you go from east to west and north to south, but it's all the same species.
Well, and they do have fantastic tails.
Yes, they do. And they probably, I would say yesterday morning and this morning, as they were sleeping, they had that tail tucked over their noses to help keep them warm, you know. The other fox that we may have had here, we certainly don't anymore, but Jim Dinsmore talks about it in A Country So Full of Game, his History of Wildlife in Iowa, the book that came out a decade or so ago. Wonderful book, and it talked about there being in western Iowa some evidence that there was that swift fox was here as well. They're quite a bit smaller. They're much more common in the Great Plains, farther west of here than they are everywhere in Iowa. But there's some chance that we had a third species as well.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, let's turn our conversation now to a larger canine that lives in Iowa and our plentiful these days,
and that is
the coyote. So tell us just a little bit about this incredibly adaptable canine.
Well, when you're thinking about a fox might be 10 to 12 pounds. A coyote is more in the range of 15 to 40 pounds at full size. So they're bigger, and the 15-pound sizes are really found more in the southwestern United States. The ones we have here are more in the 35 to 45 pound range at full size. So these are another really adaptable canid. They can run at incredible speeds if they need to. Like the foxes, they live in small family groups that may consist of a pair plus current year's pups, and occasionally some hangers-on from previous year's pups, aunties, if you will, but they may be male as well, so aunts and uncles that may hang on and help feed some of the young. They're a gray overall, certainly. They look very wolf-like. And I talk about their adaptability because as wolves, these were primarily a western species. And I mean, by western, I mean west of the Mississippi, including Iowa. We had certainly had some from pre-European settlement days. But as wolves were extirpated, wiped out in the eastern part of the U.S., coyotes readily moved right into that territory. So coyotes are very wide-ranging in North America. They've ranged, they've expanded their range up clear into Alaska, all across Canada, except for the very northern Arctic regions, and all the way down to Panama. So these are a really adaptable dog-like critter.
And when do we normally see them?
Well, again, they adapt to human beings. That's one of the reasons they've survived so well. If they're being persecuted by humans, they'll tend to be very nocturnal. And certainly that's when we hear them is at night. But certainly they will hunt very early in the morning. They can hunt at night. And under normal conditions, without human interference, you would even see them during the day. But they're certainly nocturnal or crepuscular, especially.
And people who see them sometimes are frightened of them. They don't have a history of hurting human beings.
No, not at all. But increasingly, like foxes, they have been moving into urban areas. Again, this is a critter that is very adaptable, very opportunistic. And we now know from recent studies that, for example, in the city of Chicago, they now think that the population, and I'm talking about urban downtown city of Chicago, not just the suburbs, there are over 2,000 coyotes living within the city of Chicago.
Wow.
It's pretty impressive. This is an adaptable critter.
And they're largely invisible, which is really amazing.
Yeah, yeah. They stick to the wooded areas, but also to the alleys. They've figured out how to take advantage. They've lived very well with humans. They're pretty adaptable. They've figured out what kinds of things that humans live behind and what kinds of prey that they can take advantage of that humans, by being humans, have attracted, everything from rats to raccoons and rabbits and, all kinds of the critters that we do see every day. But they take advantage of that.
Well, and we have another guest on the line now. Marlene Ayersman is here. She is executive director and founder of the Iowa Wildlife Center. Hello, Marlene.
Hello, Charity. Hello, Jim.
Hi there.
Thank you so much for calling in today, Marlene. And I've learned that you rehabilitated an orphaned coyote this year?
Yeah, although I'm not sure rehabilitated is quite the term. It was such a learning experience that it almost rehabilitated me. She was, we were called by the USDA plant introduction station here on the edge of Ames, who had three orphaned raccoons wandering around, howling at passing fire trucks and
not raccoons, coyotes.
Did I say raccoons?
Yes.
Yes, you did.
Oh, well, no, coyotes. Yes, coyotes.
I was waiting to see where that was going. Okay.
Yeah, no, coyotes. I caught a raccoon trying to catch the coyotes, but no. So the coyotes were orphaned indeed, and the sad part is too, they were suffering from sarcoptic mange. And which is often the case amongst coyotes. It seems to run courses throughout generations. And
sarcoptic mange, for people who are not familiar with it, a little parasite that lives on the body.
Yes, it's a mite that causes thickened epidermis, thickened skin, and severe infection.
And hair loss.
And it does affect the organs after they've had it for a while. So death is if the animal is debilitated in the beginning and then gets the mange mites, it's just a downward spiral. And being orphaned, these little critters were certainly not going to be long for the world. They were 2 months old, we figured, so they probably had already been out hunting maybe a few times anyway with the parents and maybe even knew how to pounce on a mouse. We were able to save only one of them. We caught her first, and the other two were quickly trap wary. One died in the field, sadly, and the other one we did end up catching, but he died within a few days. So it was quite it was one of those amazing experiences that taught us all a lot about not only the disease but about trapping coyote pups. And about how this family of coyotes was living on the edge of Ames, and nobody knew it except the plant introduction station, who loved having them there because of their control of rabbits and mice. So
they were living very close to people and not doing any harm. How old do you think this little pup was when you did catch her?
Well, we decided she was just based on when coyotes are typically born in Iowa. We caught her in right around the 5th of July, and she probably was 2 months old at that point.
All right. And at that point, what would you feed her? How did you care for her other than treating the mange?
Right. We immediately started. We have veterinarians that volunteer with us, the doctors gave her a thorough exam and started her on fluids, and then we gave her a really high quality, soft dog food, puppy food. and we're able to get her to start eating, and she just slowly gained. And we kept our distance. We wanted to minimize human contact because that's the one thing. Jim mentioned how smart they are, and once they lose their fear of humans, then they tend to get into trouble, and it doesn't usually end well for the coyote. So we wanted to minimize human contact with her. She was weaned, you know, we didn't need to give her milk, so that was good, didn't need to bottle feed her. So we started backing off on our contact of her, and just would put in the dog food and treat her for mange, catch her a couple of times, once every 2 weeks for four different treatments to treat the mange, and make sure her weight was increasing. And she did quite well and stayed wild.
And she's been released?
We did release her. We released her October 20th. So we had her for about 3 months.
And coyotes are very social creatures with each other. When a lone coyote goes off into the world, I mean, Jim, you can jump in here too. How would they make their way into a coyote community?
Well, I think Marlene can tell you how this one did. They certainly, you know, there's always a chance if you release them into a territory in which they're not familiar, they will travel quite a distance before they find an open territory. But this one, I think, had already made friends, if you will, or made acquaintance with a local coyote. You want to relate that story, Marlene?
Sure. When we built a large enclosure out on Wildway, which is the Wildlife Center property near the ledges. We built a large enclosure out there and moved her out there. We worried, Charity, you're right. They're a very social animal, and we actually looked for another coyote pup to put in with her, but there was only one in the state that we could find, and that one had been really highly socialized to humans and dogs, raised with family dogs, and so we decided that wasn't the right situation. And this coyote knew that she was a coyote. She was old enough. We conferred with other experts across the nation, and they agreed that she was old enough. We didn't need to find another one to socialize her to coyotes. She knew who she was. So when we moved her out to the enclosure out on Wildway, one of our volunteers went out to feed one morning and saw a wild coyote on the outside of the enclosure, and they were touching noses. They were saying hello, and perhaps they had done this before, and we just had never seen it. So we were, and that was very hopeful, and the volunteer just stepped back and watched for a while, and pretty soon that coyote trotted off, but it was a male. We do know that because it marked the territory as it left.
So a male out looking for a female, perhaps.
Yep, and she was probably, just when we released her, she would have been, I think they breed right around, they can breed around 6 months sometimes. So she maybe, you know, they formed a bond, and that's what we're hoping for.
Well, Marlene, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Marlene Ayersman is the executive director and founder of the Iowa Wildlife Center. And Jim, we have a number of questions about what coyotes do eat. Sherry in West Des Moines wants to know if coyotes kill deer.
Well, they will take usually small fawns. Unlike wolves, coyotes usually hunt solo. Occasionally they will, again, they're adaptable. You will see a couple kind of working together, but for the most part they hunt solo, and so they really can't take something much bigger than themselves down at all. So a full-sized deer is really, unless it's really in bad shape, quite old or lame or something like that, they can't possibly take them down. Their jaws actually aren't strong enough probably to do the job on them that a wolf jaw could, for example. So, but a young deer, a fawn, they could certainly take. But almost all of their diet consists of mammals, mice and squirrels and rabbits and voles, and then they supplement it certainly with birds, with snakes, with occasionally with deer fawns, with insects, with lots of berries. They will eat vegetable matter. They'll eat carrion. They'll eat some insects. Very highly varied diet, but it's almost always dominated by small mammals.
Well, and as Marlene was saying, in natural circumstances, coyotes are very wary of humans, and they
yes.
don't want to spend time near us. However, in some of our urban communities, coyotes do get very creative with what they might eat, and they can be a danger to some of our small pets, right?
Yeah, absolutely. They will, if people let their cats roam around at night, they could very likely become coyote food because coyotes are, as I mentioned earlier, certainly in our urban areas and small towns around the outskirts, very, very common across the state, across the country. There are concerns in some areas about them becoming overly socialized, too used to humans. And then coming right into backyards and that sort of thing. And that's certainly a concern and needs to be dealt with on the individual level, just as they are when they depredate livestock. In a study that was done in Canada in the 70s, they found that a lot of it was done by koi dogs. And we can talk some more about koi dogs right after the break.
All right. Thank you very much. Wildlife biologist Jim Pease is here today. We're talking about wild canines. We've been talking about fox and coyote. And in a few minutes, we'll also talk about wolves. And you can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is wildlife biologist Jim Pease. We're talking about wild canines this hour. We've been talking about red fox, gray fox, coyote, and we'll talk about wolves in a moment. And we do have a number of people who want to join our conversation, Jim, so let's get to some questions right now, and then we'll
sure.
get back to talking about coyotes in a little while. The number to call is 866-780-9100, and John is on the line in Clarksville. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Yeah, I live out in the country, and I was wondering if I put a salt block out. I know I'll attract a lot of deer, but would that have any chance of attracting red or gray foxes?
Oh, probably not. They might use it a little bit, but salt blocks generally aren't terribly attractive to canids. If you put out roadkill, you're much more likely to attract them. I don't encourage people at all to feed wild critters. Let them do their own thing. If you provide the habitat, they'll be around. And I realize you want to see them. But that's how they tend to get into trouble. As Marlene mentioned, it's when they are acclimated to humans and to humid food that they tend to get into trouble by taking things that they weren't supposed to, they weren't intended to take, or at least the human didn't intend them to take, but they're opportunistic. And the more you provide food for them, the more chances are that they're going to be acclimated to you and dependent upon that food. And that's not going to end up well for them in so many ways. So I wouldn't encourage you to do that. And salt blocks, really, you're right, you're probably just going to attract a lot of deer to that area, and that can be a problem as well.
All right. Well, sorry about that, John. But so if John wants to see fox in the wild, do you have any advice for him? I knew where a den was in Ames a long time ago, but he's in Clarksville, so.
Yeah, that's a ways away. You might just ask around. He could start in some of the county parks. There's one right near the Clarksville area there, and take a look and talk to the naturalists there, and find out where there are foxes around. Tell them you just want to be able to see them. Now they will use dens through the winter. And during, like a lot of our small mammals, during the really severe weather, they tend to den up for a few days and don't go out, get out and hunt when you've got a blizzard going on. They don't go out any more than we do. So they will they'll use those dens. It may or may not be the same dens that they used during the summertime. But oftentimes they will use some of those dens, at least, particularly if they have a south exposure during the wintertime. So, and it's a great time to see both gray fox and red fox in the wintertime. If we have a snow cover, you get that contrast with a white background, and it's much easier to see them in the wintertime.
Now, of course, there are a number of hunting seasons going on right now, including fox hunting season. So if you go out, wear orange or something very bright, right?
Yeah, exactly. And if you're in an area that is allowed to be hunted, the trapping season runs from November 2nd to January 31st, and the hunting season is the same for both. Coyotes, it's the same for fox. The hunting season is the same. But the coyotes is actually a continuous open season year-round on them. So,
all right.
Yeah.
We have another question. This is from Shelley. She says, we've had two different foxes in our shrubbery in our front yard in the past 2 weeks. Never seen one before now. We live on River Drive in Davenport in the middle of town. The first time, it seemed the fox was stalking our neighbor's cat. I was coaxing the cat out of the shrub so my golden retriever wouldn't give chase, and up popped a very large fox. Do foxes hunt cats or small animals? Would it attack my dog?
It wouldn't probably attack your dog, depending on the size, unless it's a very small dog. Because usually, you know, you're talking a 10 to 12 pound maximum. That's pretty big for a fox. And taking on a dog of the same size, they're not going to do that readily at all. Cats, on the other hand, they certainly would take, given the opportunity, particularly small cats. Not very wary cats, and or cats that have been declawed, they'll certainly take them. So it's another reason to keep your cats indoors most, if not all, of the time.
Well, and of course, I mean, foxes also, as we were talking about, they look bigger than they really are.
Right, right.
Their tail
because of that
is
fur.
The fur and their tail is as long as their body is.
Right,
They may be.
And they have that under fur, so they look a lot thicker than they really are, especially this time of year. So.
All right, and this is from Dave. He says, I was fascinated to find out that our two species of foxes, the gray fox and the red fox, are so distantly related. That reason, or that being the reason that the gray fox still possessed the primitive ability to climb trees. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, they're different habitats. Gray foxes are much more woodland oriented. They are different genera. Vulpes is the red fox, and Eurocyon is the gray fox. But they're both canids. It certainly that they had separate evolutionary lines. Is indicated by the difference in genus. And today we're able to do, because we can now do genetic studies, we're finding out a whole lot more about relationships between the canids. And he's absolutely right in that the gray fox seems to be just totally unrelated to the red fox.
And they do not interbreed.
No, they do not.
All right.
Whereas
canid familiaris.
Other canids, yeah. I mean, the coy dog cross. I started before the break to talk about that. And when a coyote and a dog cross, now, one of the ways you know that is coyotes come into estrus. The females ovulate once a year. Domestic dogs are twice a year. And usually the hybrid, when you get the coy dog, the hybrid between the two, they have pups in the middle of the winter. So they actually have estrus twice a year. So, and although they may look like a coyote when they interbreed with, you know, farm dogs or whatever, the feral dogs that are out there, when they interbreed, they get what's called hybrid vigor, and they can be quite a bit larger than a normal coyote. they have the lack of fear of humans, of dogs, and they have the intelligence of the coyote. And very, very often, I mentioned the study in northern Canada, northern Alberta, they about 95% of the depredation problems on livestock was caused not by coyotes, but by coy dogs. And it was that interbreeding that was the problem. And it's often the case. And now with genetic studies, we know that there has been some interbreeding. In the East Coast populations, there appears to be some interbreeding between coyotes and wolves on a very limited basis. There are certainly some genetics there that are different than wolves in other places in the country.
So when there's interbreeding, that's when there can be real problems.
Real problems, yeah, yeah. Now, that's not to say that we might not have problems as coyotes get more acclimated to urban areas, but that remains to be seen.
All right. Well, let's talk about wolves a little bit, because that is a species that has certainly made a tremendous comeback in many areas of mm-hmm. North America. Wolves did used to live in Iowa, right?
Yes, they did. And in fact, that the wolf that is common all over, well, once was common all over the United States, is the gray wolf. There is a separate species called the red wolf, which was sort of southeastern U.S., but the gray wolf, and then people talk about timber wolves and prairie wolves and everything, those are sort of what biologists would call subspecies, but they certainly are not, some genetic isolation, it may be speciation taking place, but they haven't quite separated. Certainly if you put them together, they would interbreed. But so the ones that were common, most common in Iowa, were the prairie wolf subspecies of the gray wolf. But so gray wolves you're talking a much larger critter. You're talking anywhere from 50 to 90 pounds, sometimes more than that. The big males can get even larger than that. So again, we're stepping up in size. Like the coyotes, wolves live up to about 10 years in the wild, longer in captivity, certainly. But the behavior is very, very different. Wolves are inherently a pack animal. While you do hear of occasionally the quote-unquote lone wolf, that's usually a wolf setting out on its own because it's been run out of a territory, run out of a family group, and is seeking a new territory on their own. And they will form a pack. But they hunt in packs. They raise their young in packs. There's a very strict sort of social order within a pack. It's very, very different than coyotes or foxes, which tend to be, while they will have family groups, they tend to be more solitary and hunt more solitarily.
So they have made a comeback, first at Yellowstone, but now there are wolves in Minnesota. There are wolves in Michigan. Is there a chance that wolves will return to Iowa, do you think?
Oh, I think there is. There are wolves in Wisconsin, too. And those wolves, while the ones in Minnesota were a remnant population of the wild wolves that have always been there, wolves had not come back into Wisconsin. And they were in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan as well, both of which Minnesota and Wisconsin are connected to Wisconsin, or Minnesota and Michigan, the UP of Michigan,
right,
are connected to Wisconsin. So you would think, gee whiz, why hasn't
Wisconsin is beautiful.
Why
wouldn't
you?
Well,
they did. They came.
Right.
They came in on their own when the deer population got high enough. When the prey, and again, this is that adaptability of the critter. You know, they saw an opportunity for prey there, and I don't know how many packs there are now, but this is, I think, the first year they're allowing actually a hunting season on wolves in Wisconsin. First time in modern history since they were extirpated in the late 1800s, early 1900s from basically the upper Midwest, except for very, very northern Minnesota and very, very northern Michigan. So they are back in Wisconsin to the point where they feel that they can be taken in a limited hunting season. And we'll see what happens. It'll be interesting because that puts another pressure on the populations. And they may, move out. I'm a little bit surprised we haven't had them in Iowa already, because the closest pack that I knew of was in sort of west central Wisconsin near Black River Falls and Eau Claire, that area, which is not that far from northeastern Iowa. And we had a high deer population, very high deer population at one time, similar to what Wisconsin had, not quite that high, but a pretty good population. So I thought they might exploit it. And so far, they haven't crossed the river and come into Iowa. But I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with the additional, with the hunting season, if that puts additional pressure on them and causes them to move around a bit more, and maybe they will find it. Come into Iowa. That'll be interesting.
So. It will be interesting. You know, of course, we don't have a lot of timber in Iowa.
Right.
We're not an ideal habitat for wolves.
Well, we're not ideal, not so much because we don't have timber, because, they, as I said, there was this prairie wolf subspecies that did very, very well in our prairies without many woods at all, and hunted the bison and elk in Iowa when before Euro-American settlement. They did really well, and these were large critters. They're much taller than the timber wolf subspecies was. But the problem in Iowa is that it's been so converted to row crop agriculture, there just isn't a lot of habitat left for them, either prairie or woodland. So I think they would be restricted to, habitat-wise to northeastern section of Iowa, but we'll see.
Well, and we have, of course, had a few sightings of cougars in the state of Iowa. Mm-hmm. We've had sightings of black bears in the state of Iowa. So you think that wolves might be next, and in the near future that we might have a one-off kind of experience like that?
Yeah, I think it wouldn't surprise me at all that we will have. In fact, I'm kind of surprised, as I said, that we haven't yet. But it wouldn't surprise me at all. And I don't think they'll ever become common in the state as coyotes have. They're not nearly as adaptable as coyotes are. And they have been persecuted for so long by humans. I don't think, even though they are protected by a continuous closed hunting season, unlike bears and cougars, I don't think that the human population of Iowa is going to put up with them for very long, unfortunately.
Yeah. So, yeah. We have this email from Lori to close the show. When we built a new home in the open country, we feared for our petite Siamese cat. We woke one night to see her out on the lawn with a barking fox circling in the shadows. She finally had enough and ran him off. This occurred night after night and seemed to be more of a game between the two of them.
It's fascinating.
Well,
this is one tough cat.
It's true. But foxes, I have noticed out running in the woods with my dogs that if we come across a fox, they will often lead the dog on a chase,
yeah.
Although there's just no chance that the dog is ever going to catch them. And that's
right.
That's a behavior that they'll do to steer away from a dog away from their den.
It's like teasing.
Right. It sure looks like a game, doesn't it?
Sure. It sure does. And it may very well be. You know, I think that there's a lot of evidence among animal behaviorists that animals do indeed play, and that they would play with another critter, another species. I don't find that out of the realm of the possible at all. So it could be fun.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for
my
being
pleasure.
Here today.
And the fox does say bark, 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 bark.
All right. We'll bear that in mind. Jim Pease is a wildlife biologist. He's also an environmental interpretive and a wildlife consultant based in Ames. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins, with technical support today from Jason Burns. And Ben Kiefer is here, host of River to River, coming up today at noon. Hello, Ben.
Hi, Charity. We continue with the Jims at noon. We have Jim Leach, our former congressman here in Iowa, serving Iowa for 30 years as a member of the U.S. House of Representatives. A real treat to have him on the program, along with Jim McCormick of Iowa State University, one of our regular hands, as we look at recent politics. So we hope our listeners will join in with questions and comments about, well, initially, how we have this debilitating rancor in Washington. We talk about it very often, how we got into it, how we should get out of it. All right. Coming up at noon, Politics Day.
I think I'll be an honorary Jim for the rest of the day, too. How about you, Ben?
Let's dub everyone honorary Jims.
All right. That's coming up today on River to River at noon. I am Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, I'll talk with the author Margaret Atwood. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.